hola, hola, amigos, amigos, players, playerettes, dudettes, everybody in between. This is welcome back. I am Morgan Wright. Hey, and I guess you guys know that because I'm here literally with my partner in crime,
Steve Murphy, but everybody calls me Murph.
No, they don't. There's a lot of other stuff they call you.
Well, that's true. They include my wife. You should hear some of the names she calls me.
Yeah. No longer does she call you Stud Muffin.
haven't heard that one in a long time.
That was a long time ago. Hey, guys, well, welcome back. Hey, this is going to be a fun one. For those of you who are in the know in our Patreon, you already know what episode is coming up, but we're not going to talk about that yet. You know why? Because if you're not in the know, we're going to tell you how to join Patreon in a little bit and become in the know. But in the meantime, we've got to get through our housekeeping because that's what the script says. Hey, head on over to that Apple 5 stars. It helps us out, that and Spotify. Really helps us out, guys, a lot. We really appreciate it. Also, head on over to our website, gameofcrimespodcast.com. We have books. We have things that our guests write that are on there. And we've got some good guests coming up with some terrific books that you're going to love. We just got through recording an episode for another one of Murph's pals. And his story about a shooting is awesome. But his collection of stories, it's even better, isn't it, Murph?
Oh, that book, you start reading it and you can't put it down. It's just... It may have had to do with I knew most of the people in the book. Even was partners with Chris Feistel from our Cali edition of DEA Narcos. So, but it's excellent, excellent read.
Yeah. Also, if you want to hear more stuff, just follow us on that thing they call the social media at Game of Crimes on Twitter, at Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. But Murph, if you want to be in the know and you want to know what's coming up, where do you got to be? Where do you got to be? I ask you, where do you got to be?
You got to come on over and check us out on Patreon, Patreon.com/Game of Crimes. There is so much content on there. We say this every week, but it's true. We spend more time recording content for Patreon than we do for the regular podcast. And you know how many hours we're putting out here because you're listening to us. Come over, check out our we have Q&A, a monthly Q&A. You can ask us anything. You can come over and do 911, what's your emergency? You can listen to our episode. You can't make this shit up because the stuff that Morgan comes up with, you can't make this shit up. It's crazy.
We scowl the bowels of the internet so you don't have to.
We do a police movie critique every month. We do a case of the month. It's just sometimes we just get on there. We do a live stream every month now. There's a lot of stuff you can come and join us with, so come and check us out.
Yeah, and you're going to want to do Case of the Month. We Murph and I talk about this, one of our more serious discussions we've had about the Parkland shooter, the piece of shit, we will not give his name, and the fact that the jury came back and did not recommend death. It was 9-3 for death, but it has to be unanimous, so he got life instead. So we're going to talk about that, but anyway, we'll save that for later, so make sure you do that. Also, head on over to paypal.com. Oh, by the way, Steve, where you can find us is patreon.com/gameofcrimes. We almost got past our Patreon thing without telling people where to find us. That's patreon.com/gameofcrimes. One more time, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. And you can also just use our email, head on over to paypal.com, gameofcrimespodcast@gmail.com, or paypal.me/gameofcrimes. Whatever it makes it easier for you to support the show, you know, and help us bring you more exciting content. Now, before we get into the show, we got to tell you a couple things. First of all, you got to go join our fan group. Just head on over at Game of Crimes. Just type that into Facebook. You're going to find it, Game of Crimes Fans. The Mafia Queen, Sandy Salvato, will determine if you are worthy of admission. All you have to do is just even get close, answer a couple questions. Head on over there, just a couple easy questions. So you got to do that. You have to do that so we can give you the disclaimer, which is the disclaimer is this is a show about crime. We talk about bad people doing bad things and bad people doing bad things to good people. Steve, we take the story seriously, but...
We never, never take ourselves serious.
And how do we prove we don't take ourselves serious?
Listen to our show. You'll find out.
Yeah, and one of the things we other do, we talk about things that may happen in small towns. So guess what time it is, Murph?
It's time for Small Town Police Blotter.
Yay! Hey, and this first story comes to us from Steve, not Stephen King. We've got some Steves on here. There's a Stephen, not Seagal Siegel, but this is Steve, not Stephen King. Mm-hmm. Send us a story here, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of things I heard of... being stolen, but I've never heard of this being stolen before. Police said two men were arrested after they were caught stealing cooking oil from a business in Colorado. Officers were dispatched around 8:45 a.m. for a report that two men were stealing cooking oil from the back of the building, according to the Pocono Township Police Department. Now, we have to go check the interwebs and find out. Let's do this in real time. Hey, Siri, what is the population of Pocono Township, Colorado? 10,931.
Salute.
There we go. Police said the suspects, identified as somebody named Roe and Roe, both of Flushing, New York. There you go, Flushing.
And they both have a boat. That's row, row your boat.
Row, row, row your boat. Flush it down the stream. Fled the scene in a white Chevy truck with a large metal tank and a pump on the back. The truck was spotted attempting to get on interstate. They stopped them. They arrested them. They were taken and charged with theft by unlawful taking of movable property, which apparently cooking oil is movable. Now, you may ask, why is this a big deal? Because apparently this is a case of one of many across the nation. More than 100 gallons of cooking oil was stolen from a restaurant in Rhode Island. Why would you steal that? Because we're going to learn something. They said the restaurant grease is often bought for a price within a range of 30 cents to $1. It is produced, but he said the real value comes from what you can turn it into. You can now turn it into domestic biofuel. And when you see what the prices of those are things, man, you can get up to $4 a gallon for stuff that is bought for 30 cents to $1 a gallon.
What do you use that kind of fuel for?
To be economically friendly and fuel domestic biofuel. So biodiesel, I guess, biofuels.
Really?
If you want to lubricate your car up, I guess you put cooking oil in it. We don't suggest you do that directly, but...
So if you stole 100 gallons and you got $4 a gallon for it, that's $400, right?
Steve, so you're pretty sharp, man. Yeah,
I've got my socks on too. I didn't even have to take them off. But you'd go to jail for $400.
$400, and all that work to get 100 gallons of cooking oil. All right,
idiots.
All right, well, hey, Steve. Let's. This one's a shorter story, but more impactful, because we've all had this happen to us at probably one time or another. A woman along the block of 37th Avenue reported a dispute with her neighbor, who is also her boyfriend, because he was refusing to bring her a casserole.
Well, are you hungry, you know? You get hangry.
You get hangry, that means you get angry, and then somebody's going to, I got to call it. He didn't bring me a casserole.
So what'd she do to it?
Doesn't say. The story just says she just wanted to. That's my point. Why would you call the police? Well, speaking of the police.
That's like
Steve,
going to McDonald's and you don't get your McNuggets.
We had a story about that on our 911 calls, remember?
I know it.
So, Steve, speaking of the police, you know, they like to help the community. One of those things is outreach and education. So the Maysville, North Carolina Police Department, population 9,010.
Salute.
They decided, hey, look, we're going to have a report form. And they sent it out. Attention, Maysville drug dealers. Is your drug dealing competition costing you money? We offer a free service to help eliminate your drug competition. Report your competition to us. So here are the things. My drug dealing competition is fill in the blank. My drug dealing competition lives at fill in the blank. My drug dealing competition's phone is fill in the blank. My drug dealing competition's vehicle is fill in the blank. Other means of contact. My drug dealing competition sells during the hours of fill in the blank. And my drug dealing competition sells the type of drugs, fill in the blank. So mail or drop off your drug dealer's information or call, the number on your screen. Give your name and tell them who you're reporting.
The only thing missing on that at the bottom is if you'd like to provide additional information, where can we contact you?
Yeah, where can we contact you? Yes. Well, hey,
let's wait and see if there's anybody stupid enough to fill that out.
Give us your name and address and phone number, and we'll enter you into our monthly drawing for a search warrant. Yeah, a search warrant free of charge.
I like that.
But you know what I like, Steve?
What?
I like our next guest coming up. That's what
yeah.
I like.
Yeah, good friend. This is a guy that Javier and I got to meet about 5 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago at the, you've heard us talk on other shows about the Southern California Gang Conference. That's something that we support. Now Morgan's a supporter of it as well. And the reason we support it is because all the money they raise for their conference goes to the families of slain officers during the previous year in Southern California. And so part of that was when the first time Javier and I went out to speak at that conference, we got to meet Joe Pistone. He's an honorary member of their board out there. And I tell you what, man, people sit down and they ask us, you know, hey, can we ask you questions? Because they want to hear our stories. this guy, Joe Pistone, he has got stories that I could just sit there. I was the same way. We could sit there and listen to him all freaking day. I mean, this man, six years undercover in the New York crime families, the mafia crime families, primarily the Bonanno family, a little bit of the Colombo family, but just deep undercover for 6 years. Nobody knew where he was except for maybe one or two agents. It's unbelievable what you're getting ready to hear. I can't believe he put himself through all this.
Well, Murph, you know, people wondered what you did for a job, you know, for 6 years too, but...
That's not something I want to talk about.
No, but the difference is they did well. And guess what? You disappeared for a while. They made a movie about you in a series. They made a movie about Joe. And this is the cool part. This is the guy. I mean, Johnny Depp plays him in the movie Donnie Brasco.
Mm-hmm.
But the movie does not do the story justice.
Right. Absolutely.
This guy, to this day, he's still concerned about his safety. He thought we recorded things both audio and video, and we don't. We just record things on audio, but we can see each other on video to enhance the recording experience. And he showed up still, ball cap, dark glasses, mm-hmm. Kind of that witness protection look.
You know, he's a friend of mine, and I still, to this day, I know his wife, Maggie. I know one of his three kids. And,
but?
You know, I don't know where he lives. And I won't ask him.
We won't ask because if we don't know, we can't tell and inadvertently let it slip.
True. True. So,
although it's a place that has a room with a light and a window and a computer and a camera, that narrows it down, doesn't it, Murph?
Oh, there was nothing on the walls behind him to identify anything associated with him. You can tell the man has done this before.
Yeah. And look, and we're not making light of it. It's just the fact that you think about this after all these years and the damage he did to these families and the convictions that it resulted in. Mm-hmm. But you know what? It was the damage it did to him and his family and his relationships that he has spent years now working on and repairing. But you know what? It was one of those things. Maybe, as you guys know, sometimes maybe it's a distorted sense of a priority. But man, when you get into this job and you realize the damage these people do, it's if not me, then who? If I don't do this investigation, if I don't get to these guys, then who?
Right. You know, and as risky as it is to Joe and the work that he did, his family suffered. And we talk about that in his interview.
Yep.
So you'll hear it. We don't want to waste your time here. We want to get right to his interview. But man, you're in for a treat, I promise you.
Yeah. So, Murph, if they're in for a treat, the only way to treat them to the upcoming treat and so they feel treated is for me to ask you the one treat question of all time, right? Are you ready to play the biggest, baddest, most dangerous, and Donnie Brasco game of all, game of crimes?
Absolutely. And everybody, this truly is one to get in, sit down, shut up, and hold on. Bring on the real Donnie Brasco, Joe Pistone.
Yeah, we're gonna make this guy into a star. Even though, who played you in that movie? Who was that guy that was just something or other? Deb, Captain Jack. It was Captain Jack Sparrow.
He's all over now. My God.
Well, if you guys haven't figured it out yet, we have been hunting this guy down. We actually had to get the U.S. Marshals employ hunter and trackers to nail this guy down, and we finally got him. This is the guy. That one, probably one of the most infamous mob stories ever made, turned into a big movie with Johnny Depp and somebody we just reviewed here recently, Steve, Al Pacino.
Yep, yep.
In the movie Donnie Brasco, the agent it was based on, the man, the myth, the legend himself, Mr. Joe Pistone. Welcome to the broadcast of Game of Crimes.
Well, thanks for having me, fellas. I enjoy it. I mean, Steve and I go back a long way, so this isn't our first get together. So, but thanks for inviting me on your show.
It's a pleasure. Brother, I tell you what, it's a true honor to have you on here, Joe. This is, you know, people come to Javier and I, and the first time we met Joe was out in California, as a matter of fact. Javier and I were together. And people come to us and ask us for stories, and we'll tell stories. And then we sat down with Joe. We were all at that big dinner table one night. You know, overlooking we were at that hotel where we did the conference. Your wife was there. The organizers from the hotel were there. Everybody was there. And we sat at the end of the table and Joe told us stories. And from then on, when people say, hey, tell me a story, I'm like, no. Let me introduce you to Joe. He's got the freaking stories. You're not going to believe this shit that he did. So it's, I mean, it's just, you know, I hate to be a fangirl here, Joe, but damn, I mean, you've got a life, brother. And that's what we want to talk about today.
Yeah.
We want to talk about it. Cosa Nostra, this, you know, thing of ours here, this thing called law enforcement. So, you know, everybody knows you were an FBI agent, you know, you did this, but what, give us a little bit of background on what made you want to go into law enforcement? I mean, do you have family, friends? Did you lose a bet? You were drunk one night? You know, what happened to get you started on this thing?
Well, I didn't lose a bet because I'm not a drinker, as Steve can attest. I mean, my drinking is a half a bottle of beer and maybe one glass of wine. So it wasn't the drink. I don't know. I always wanted to be a cop. Maybe because growing up in Paterson, New Jersey, you know, back then in the day, the cops were your friends. They walked the beat, so they knew you. You knew the cop, they know you, and they were all great guys. You know, if you were doing something out of line, they'd give you a kick in the ass and send you home. You know, so that's what I always wanted to do that. I was a senior in college, and I took the police exam, and I made it. I got appointed, but then I found out I had to drop out of college and go to the police academy. So I was in my last year. I didn't want to drop out, so I turned down the appointment.
Which police agency?
It was the Passaic County Park Police in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm. And where were you in college at?
Pardon?
Where were you in college at? Where'd you go to college?
So I graduated school, and I applied to Naval Intelligence. And while I was getting my background checked out and everything, I taught school for a year. And then I got appointed to the Office of Naval Intelligence. I worked there. I worked out of Philadelphia and got recruited by the FBI. Actually, I had applied for DEA and the FBI, but back then, this dates me a little bit. DEA was the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs.
Yeah, BND. And
I had applied for both. And I got called first by the FBI, so I went into the...
Let's rewind for just a second. So where did you go to college at, though, that you said during your senior year? Where were you going to college at?
I was going to William Paterson University.
And that's... So, but you applied for the police and the Office of Naval Intelligence, or how did that work out?
No, I applied for the police department when I was a senior in college. And like I say, I passed the physical, the written, whatever.
But you didn't want to drop out of college.
I didn't want to drop out of college. Yeah, yeah.
So what'd you get your degree in?
My degree was in history, social studies history, yeah.
All right.
Well, that's going to serve you well later because there's a lot of history in what we're going to talk about. But from there, then you went to apply for the Navy, right?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So what made you apply for the Navy?
Well, I went to apply to the FBI, but I didn't have any work experience. You know, back then you needed 3 years work experience. And I only had the year out of college. So I applied for, you know, I went to different federal agencies and Department of Defense agencies. And I put in my application and I got called by Naval Intelligence.
So yeah. How long were you with, so obviously with your degree then, you came in as a ensign then?
Yeah, it actually was a civilian, but the grade would have been an ensign as far as, you know, the rank. It was enjoyable work and, you know, you worked a lot with other federal agencies. Actually, I worked with the FBI and Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs back then. So
this was during the Cold War too, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So did you get involved in some any neat stuff working with the Navy that you can talk about? Like jump out of an airplane, attack a submarine? What'd you do? Go to Russia and talk with the Kremlin?
No, I went to Russia later with the FBI.
Jeez. I bet you didn't have a tail over there, did you? Nobody's following you.
Oh, my God. That's how much the FBI thought of me. They sent me to Russia twice and Siberia once. So.
Oh, and you still came back.
Yeah, I came back. Couldn't like get out of there penny. Fast enough. Yeah.
So how long did you spend in the Navy then?
Almost 3 years, yeah.
So during that time, what were a couple of like the fun things that you got to do, considering your work?
Well, back then we were working closely with the FBI, plus all crimes on a government reservation. I was working out of Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Naval Base. That's where I was assigned to. And you worked espionage cases, worked criminal cases, a variety of activities, anything that you know that was committed on federal property that had to do with the.
You were more of an investigator then than an intelligence analyst.
Yeah. Basically, you're designated as a special agent. That's what you're designated as. Yeah.
And so you were the original NCIS.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
You could have been Mark Harmon instead of Donnie Brasco.
Yeah. The only thing I get a kick out of, I don't watch too much American television when it comes to police shows. But I watched that show one time and they're overseas in shootouts. And I'm thinking, man, I never knew that to happen, you know.
Well, being if they overseas, portrayed it like it really was, it'd be doing a lot of paperwork and filling out forms and doing something. Nobody's going to watch a show for that.
Yeah,
for an hour.
Exactly.
You have a lot more experience than Javier and I with Hollywood, and I know you know this. Hollywood never lets the truth get in the way of a good story, do they?
Oh, are you kidding? Never, never. My God. Yeah, I mean.
So did you get to the point to where maybe being in the Navy was more, I mean, did you just do the 3 years so you could get into the FBI? Or did you have a choice to say, hey, I really like doing this Navy stuff? What was your decision after you got that 3 years of experience in, and now you're eligible to apply for the Bureau?
Well, I had done so much work with the FBI and again with the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, and the FBI put the agents I was working with in Philly put a big push on to recruit me. So I took the test for both. I never thought I'd make the FBI. I never thought I'd make DEA either, you know. But I took the first one that came along, and the FBI was the first one that came along.
So what year did you join the FBI?
Joined the FBI in 69. July the 7th, 1969 was my EOD.
Now, were you married at that time?
Yes, I was. I was married, and I actually had three little ones. Yeah.
Wow. And I've been fortunate enough to meet the boss of the Pistone family and one of your daughters who I've seen her a couple times out in California.
You met Noreen, the one at she's a veterinarian, and she recently, the last couple of years, retired from the military. Yeah.
Can you tell us what she did in the military?
She was a veterinarian. She went to veterinarian school, became a vet, and she calls me one day and she says, Dad, what do you think about joining the Army? I said, I don't think it's a bad idea. So she joined the Army and spent 21 years in the Army. Got out as a colonel.
Nice.
Now, with a lot of her work from that side, was she working then maybe with, was she just doing what we might think a traditional vet would do, or was she really more focused on the operators, the special forces, the people with their, like the canines or the other types of things?
She did a lot of work with special forces animals, the dogs. That's one of the main things that they do is they take care of those animals. And plus they have other duties. The Army's the only branch that has a vet corps. So they take care of all the branches regarding, and they do, it's crazy because they also do food inspections, the veterinarian corps, but most of their stuff is dealing with military, the military dogs, and also on the, on certain bases, they take care of the military personnel, their personal animals. You know, they have a clinic on base that they take care of the animals of the military personnel.
Well, you know, if they're doing, if the vets are doing the food inspection, kind of makes you wonder what you're eating in the Army, doesn't it? What do you say about that, Morgan?
I was going to say, don't worry, everything tastes like chicken in the Army. You just put ketchup on it and just eat away, man. Close your eyes. Pretend it's... Don't worry about what's in there. Well, that's cool. So, but you made the decision. So for you, what was the weighing factor? Was it simply because that's what you wanted to be, was an FBI agent?
I just wanted to be, I wanted to be in law enforcement. And the more I worked with the Bureau, the more I wanted to become an agent, you know, and that's the way it went. You know, and like I say, I was fortunate enough to pass the exam, which I don't know that I'd be able to pass it today, be honest with you. But
well, you know, we're all a little older. We probably wouldn't pass the physical test. Don't worry about the written test. It's like, I got to run and do one. Can I pay somebody to do that for me?
Hey, let me tell you something. I don't know if you know this, but after 17 years, I resigned from the FBI. Stayed out for a couple years. And at 52, they sent, I went back and had to go through 22 weeks of new agents training. So
you got to be kidding me.
No, no.
Oh, my goodness. They were punishing you.
That's what it was. It was all, how dare you resign and then come back, you know, because they don't, it's very seldom that they take retreads. Once you're out, you know, once you resign, They don't look favorably about taking you back.
Well, we're going to get into that then. Let's hold on to that because I see you, Murphy. You want to ask, but
I know it's coming.
It's coming. It's but we got, you know. Hey, we're telling a story here, so let's not jump to the end of the movie yet. So, but you came on in 1969. The reason I said that's kind of at the height of the Cold War. So when you initially came on to the Bureau, did you think you were going to be doing things like you had done in the Navy, like counterintelligence, you know, and espionage cases and stuff? Or what did you end up doing when you joined the FBI? And you said you came on duty July of 69. Was Philly your first post?
No, I, excuse me, I actually came on duty in Philly. And my first office was Jacksonville, Florida. And back at that time, Jacksonville, Florida was like the Wild West.
For our players who are listening too, the other thing about Jacksonville, man, big naval presence in Jacksonville too. So you were best of both worlds for you.
Yeah, they have the base, then they have the port for the ships, and then they have a big air base. Once I got into the Bureau, I worked all criminal matters. I never worked any intelligent matters. Once I got into the Bureau, and my first assignment, I worked bank robberies, fugitives, all criminal.
So, did you like doing that, or would you prefer to do some of the counterintelligence espionage stuff?
No, actually, I enjoyed doing the criminal work. I enjoyed chasing people as far as fugitive work, doing bank robberies. I enjoyed that type of work. Later on, though, I kind of wish that I would have gotten into more of the counterintelligence. But that was, you know, after I had 20 years in, you know, but I never did. No.
So here you're a guy from New Jersey down in Florida. How was that? Was that, I mean, obviously being with the Navy, you went to go a few places, but your accent, you had to, it's a different way, you know, different way of living down in Florida versus New Jersey.
Well, back then it was, and, being an Italian, fella, I would always get, are you an Italian, from New York?
I say, no. Italian.
In the South, that's all you know to
say. I'm an Italian from New Jersey.
Hey, Joe, in the South, that's the only way we know how to say it, Italian.
Yeah, right?
It's like they're ordering dressing. I'll take some Italian dressing from our salad.
Yeah,
but they were good people. You know, I mean, the citizens were good people, very good people. But like I said, Jacksonville was pretty active as far as criminal activities.
Did you see any organized, like the mafia family activity in Jacksonville?
No, none at all. I saw a lot of what they called the Dixie Mafia was, you know, Southern gentlemen that were involved in, you know, organized criminal activities, but not as far as Italian mafia, no.
Well, but before you even got down there, did you have any coming up, you know, from New Jersey? Obviously, a lot of organized crime between New York, New Jersey back in the day, you know, the five major families. Did you have any run-ins with them growing up there or going to college or with the Navy during that time?
Actually, no. I mean, you know, I grew up in a neighborhood where there were organized crime guys. I mean, you know, look, you grew up in an Italian neighborhood, there's going to be organized crime guys. There's going to be mob guys. And I think that that's one thing that why I was always successful in my undercover activities is that I never judged anybody because I knew, you know, I knew guys that were involved in the life. There were a couple social clubs in the neighborhood. So, you know, you knew what they were about. And everybody in the neighborhood knew who the, you know, who the mob guys were. So I wasn't enamored with the life. And like I say, I never judged anybody because I knew these guys, you know. They're regular guys when they're, you know, interacting with you. It's just that you never really got to see, you know, the only illegal activities you got to see was the gambling. And the swag, you know, you need a new suit. You know, you go to the social club or whoever it is, and you grab and yourself a
miraculously
suit.
Miraculously, a suit would fall off the back of a truck somewhere that just happened to be your size.
Or you needed a sweater, or you needed a sport coat. You know, you knew where to go, and you knew that, you know, that it was swag. But hey, that's the way everybody in the neighborhood operated. That's where everybody lived. So.
But because of that, did you have any interest then in invest when you joined the Bureau? You know, like say you're down in Jacksonville, did you have any interest in at that point in going into investigating organized crime, or did that not, was that not on your radar at the point?
No, that was not on my radar. I mean, to me, a crime was a crime, and it didn't matter if you were Italian, Irish, Jewish, whatever you were. If you committed the crime, you were a suspect. I investigated. It didn't deter me one way or another.
So how long did you spend in Jacksonville?
I spent a little over a year in Jacksonville. And then I got transferred to Alexandria, Virginia.
Why'd you get transferred? I mean, a year, I mean, that's not a long time, right? You're just still getting your feet wet.
Well, back then, that's the way the Bureau operated. You were in your first office maybe 14, 15, 16 months, and then you got transferred somewhere else. That was back then. They don't do that anymore, but you're only in your first office less than 2 years.
Man, so you're in the 70s in Alexandria, Virginia. I got to tell you, I moved out here to Virginia in 2000. It's changed in the last 22 years. I would just be love to see what it was like back in the day, because you never would have heard of Loudoun County or, you know, Ashburn. These were just little farming communities out here. There was no life past maybe Tyson's Corner.
None at all. I lived out in, I first lived in Alexandria, and then I moved out to, it was a new development they were building in Burke, Virginia. And, you know, if you were going out loud and counting, you, it's like you were going to, you know, another part of the country back then.
Going to West Virginia.
Yeah.
Except we had more teeth.
But, and, you know, in Virginia, I worked, there was a lot of bank robberies because you had a lot of crossover between Washington, D.C. and Alexandria because you're right there on the border. Mm-hmm. So you had a lot of crossover with the bad guys as far as between Virginia and Washington, D.C.
But Alexandria, that was the Washington field office, right?
Or no,
was that, it was an RA?
No, it was a field office in its own. Yeah. Hmm. It's not anymore, but
that's
it
what I was
going
to say. That doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. So the Alexandria field office. Wow.
Yeah.
So what you doing? So this stint in Alexandria, how long did you spend there?
I was in Alexandria until, I got there early 74, I think. And then I got transferred to New York. Yeah.
So how is the family handling this constant move? I mean, you get moved to Jacksonville, then you get moved to Alexandria. You're just getting your roots down, and then now you're moving to New York. What's it like on the family?
Well, you know, the kids, they were young at that time, so it wasn't, you know, wasn't that much of a, I don't think, a kick in the arse to them. We had family in New Jersey, so getting transferred to New York wasn't such a big deal because I knew I was going to live in New Jersey, and I had a lot of family at the time in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. So,
now, did you ask to get transferred, or were you just in that day? Were you just transferred at the pleasure of the director?
Well, I had put in, I had put in for it. You know, you had three choices, what they called office of preference. And look, if you're in, and Steve can attest to this from DEA, if you're in the FBI and you want to work, you go to New York. Hmm. That's where you go.
Yeah. For us, it was, of course, I didn't come on until the late 80s, but it was New York, Miami, or L.A., that was
right.
The three big
yeah.
offices.
You know, and back then it was, you know, it was New York, Chicago, Detroit, or L.A., and I didn't want to go out to the West Coast, you know. Mm-hmm. So if you wanted
to... Because they probably didn't know how to say Italian correctly.
Yeah.
Well, it's like me, I didn't want to go to the West Coast either, and New York, you know.
I had a shot to go to San Diego.
No, that's not bad.
And I didn't take it, you know.
So when you put in for that, do you know what squad you're going to be on or what type of work you're going to do before you get there?
Normally, the way it worked was you went on to the applicant squad and you worked applicants.
We've heard that before, haven't we, Steve?
You had a but I was, you know, it's always good to have a godfather or a rabbi or a hook, as they say, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And I had a, I met this New York supervisor. We had an undercover seminar at Quantico, and there's a supervisor from New York by the name of Guy Barato, who was an old time New Yorker. When I say old time New Yorker, I mean, you know, he grew up in New York. New York was his second office, and so he had spent time in New York, and. So when I told him, when I got my transfer, I called Guy and said, "Hey, Guy," I said, "Man, I don't want to go to applicants." And he had enough juice to circumvent that. So I went right to the truck hijacking squad, which drew a lot of looks from other people that got transferred and were on the applicant squad.
Were you a qualified 18-wheel truck driver?
I was before I went there. Yeah, I had during college, during the summers, I had drove a 18-wheeler. So I knew, you know, yeah, I could drive 18-wheelers when I got to New York.
Were some of these hijacked trucks happen to be the same ones that were supplying the clothing for the social clubs?
They probably were.
See how life comes full circle? Yeah, I got a suit off this truck one time. Now I'm arresting you guys.
Well, I think the suit that I went to my new agent's training, I think that was a suit that I had bought out of the social club before I went into Naval Intelligence. You know, I don't know about you guys. When I went through the Bureau the first time, Quantico wasn't open. They were building Quantico, the training school. So we went to back then training was only, I think, either 14 or 16 weeks. I can't remember. But it was in Washington, D.C. So you had to get an apartment. And the Bureau had, they gave you a list of apartment buildings that you could rent an apartment in. So you had to rent an apartment. You had to pay for it yourself. And then you went to the old post office, which is now the Trump Hotel. If you guys know D.C., the old post office, and that's where we had our classroom work. And then we'd go to Quantico every so often for a week for firearms training, and we'd stay in the Marine barracks. So that's the way that operated. Yeah.
So you're probably losing money by taking that job.
I'm just saying, you got to pay for your own place to go to training and then drive. You got to live in one area and drive to another.
Yeah. Well, you know, we didn't, I didn't take a car. You know, and what you did was you had to have three guys, you know, three guys would hook up and stay in an apartment. You know, I think I had the couch. I slept on the couch. I think we had a two-bedroom apartment, so I just took the couch. You had to buy your own meals back then, too. You weren't getting supplied any meal, you know. So you had to buy your breakfast, your lunch, and your own and your dinner. Plus, you had to pay for an apartment.
So did you have to get a job like at 7-Eleven on the weekends? Or Man, that's tough. I mean, compared to today's
standard. Yeah, it was. You know, tough. Then once they opened the academy, then everything was, you know, was provided. You went through the academy, right, Steve?
I did. I did the DEA academy through the FBI academy.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It was, I can still remember the smell of hoppies in the cafeteria for every meal.
Oh, yeah, because it was right above the,
right above the gun vault. Right upstairs.
I love the smell of fresh gunpowder in the morning. What do you say, napalm in the morning, Robert Duvall?
Well, you know, they say everything tastes like chicken. Everything tastes like hoppies there.
Yeah. That's right, because it was right above the gun vault. Yeah.
Yep.
Permeates everything. So you go to New York, you start working the truck squad. And obviously, I'll make an assumption here, a lot of the hijackings of the trucks, almost exclusively organized crime.
Oh, all of them. Yeah. Nobody hijacked a truck in New York if they weren't connected some way to a family, an organized crime family. And the hijackings were, you know, high value loads of pharmaceuticals, high value food loads, like coffee was a big value load. Pharmaceuticals, big value load, shrimp. You know, you're talking an 18-wheeler. You pack a lot of coffee and a lot of shrimp into an 18-wheeler, and a lot of pharmaceuticals. So everything was controlled then by the mob, one family or another.
Were these like armed hijackings, or just takeovers, or steal them, or you know, was there a lot of violence associated with this?
There wasn't much violence, but some of them were giveaways. In other words, the drivers were, you know, were involved with the mob guys, or they'd be armed hijackings. The driver stopped at a light. The the mob guy or the whoever was doing the hijacking would come up to the driver's side door, stick a gun in the guy's face, you know, take him out of the car, take his license, his driver's license, and, you know, I know where you live now, you know. So when you went to interview the driver, you know, the guy might be 5 foot. He's saying, well, it was a 6 foot Chinese guy or whatever, you know, white guy, black guy. He never gave you the correct ID because he knew that they had his driver's license. And sometimes they'd slip the guy some money, you know, to keep his mouth shut. So some were giveaways and some were actually armed, you know, where they took the truck by force. Yeah.
Was there go ahead, Steve.
I was going to say those scenes that we saw in the movie Goodfellas where Ray Liotta and Joe Pesci are coming up and, you know, they just take the guy's truck. He goes in the restaurant and then he goes back out. His truck's gone. He comes running back in and says, oh, those black guys just took my truck. So all that's true then, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Wow.
Hey, was there any one particular family that was more responsible for the truck jackings than anybody else?
Well, it was actually there was about three or four good hijacking crews. John Gotti had a good hijacking crew. Sonny Black and, you know, Gotti Gambino. Sonny Black Napolitano had a good hijacking crew. He was a Bonanno. The Lucchese's had a good hijacking crew. These guys, I mean, that's what they did, and they were good, you know. And then what they had, they'd have what's called a drop. It's a garage somewhere where after they took the truck, they'd bring the truck to this particular warehouse, and then, you know, whatever the load was, most of the time the load was already sold. Especially the food stuff, they already had supermarkets that, you know.
Oh, yeah, because it's perishable. You can't hang on to that like you can close. But it sounds like then what they had, too, was a lot of inside information. I mean, they knew what truck was carrying what and where it was going to be.
Yes, yeah, they did. I mean, you know, how would you know?
How would you know otherwise?
That pharmaceuticals are coming out of such and such a place, you know. And a lot of times we would negotiate with the insurance company to get the load back. If, you know, it was a crazy time. I mean, we were probably averaging at the time 6 to 8 hijackings a day.
Oh, God. Dang. You know,
of high value loads. Yeah. Wow. And that's not counting. That's just counting the 18 wheelers. That's not counting the little box trucks, you know, that they were taking.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I bet the grocery stores that were buying the shrimp or whatever other foodstuffs were taking, I bet they didn't have a choice, did they? So they're having to buy stolen goods from the crime families. Yeah, and they're probably still paying extortion and protection fees.
Yeah,
right?
But they're making out too, you know, because they're not.
They're getting it for pennies on the dollar versus what they're paying.
Yeah, I got you. Yeah.
From the
real distributor,
producer, the real distributor.
So is this, I mean, this obviously, this sounds like you're starting to get now immersed into the organized crime families, the way they work and the things they do. Did that spark any interest at that point to say, hey, these are a collection of people I'd really like to go after? Or was it still more just the criminal work?
It was still criminal work. What happened was after I was in New York a few months, I had done undercover work in Jacksonville, infiltrated gambling dens, infiltrated.
Let me guess, as an Italian mobster?
No, just as an Italian thief, you know. So a job come up out of Tampa, Florida. They had a case on a group of car thieves. And the way this group worked was you'd go to them and say, I want a Mercedes-Benz. And you'd give them the color and all the goodies that you wanted. And then they'd go out and they'd hook it.
Dang.
And so they had a big case out of Tampa, and they had the ability to get an FBI, well, not and you know, to get an undercover agent in. And I got a call to see if I wanted to do the undercover, and I said, yeah. But the first thing I got to do, I got to learn how to steal cars.
Yeah.
So the agent in Tampa had an informant who was a car thief. So I spent some time with him, and he taught me how to hook different types of cars. So I got my way into this group and spent a year and a half stealing cars and tractors with these guys.
Like farm tractors or tractor trailers?
No, just the cabs. Yeah.
Yeah.
The truck tractors. And those are, man, let me tell you what, being a farm boy and being a trooper and working with those things, high dollar stuff, Kenworth, Peterbilt, you know, you've got all of these things, man, they are.
Yeah.
Driving one of those things. If you don't know how to drive a truck tractor, they can tell right away whether or not you've got any experience driving those things. Because it's not like putting it into drive, go, hey, I just put this into drive and we take off.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I did that for a year and a half and was successful. We got a ton of convictions. And I'll tell you though, we hooked a Mercedes-Benz one time around outside of Orlando, and the buyer was a guy in Miami. So I'm going to drive it from Orlando to Miami, and it's like 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, and I get pulled over by a trooper, and I mean, the only identification I have is my fake driver's license. So he says, and there were no tags on it or anything. So he said, where are you going? I said, I'm going to Miami. And he said, how come you don't have any tags in this car? I said, well, I'm bringing it from a dealership in Orlando to a dealership in Miami. And I got to get it there because it's sold, and I got to get it there by 8 o'clock in the morning, you know? So he says, let me see your driver's license. So I show him my license, and I said, I don't have any other paper for this car, but this is where I'm taking it. And he said, okay. And he lets me go. So, one situation where I talked my way out of, he checked the car. He looked in the trunk. He said, can I search the car? I said, sure, go ahead, search it. Do what you want with it, you know? I said, I just got to get there and have this car by 8 o'clock. And then he said, okay, drive slower.
What was your plan B? One thing, he could have just issued a ticket and say, hey, go on. But what if he wanted to arrest you or, hook the car up and tow it? Did you have a... what were your options at that point? Just stay in character?
Yeah, stay in character, take the arrest. And when you get your phone call, you call your contact agent, which is, an hello number, and you explain what happened.
Hey, tell everybody that's an interesting thing. It's a contact, you say it's a hello number. What do you, let everybody know what you mean by that.
Well, your contact agent, when you're working undercover,
You can't you call have, the FBI office and have FBI office, undercover division. Can I help you?
Yeah, you have a safe telephone number, and your contact agent is the agent that is your handler or control agent. That if you have a problem, that's who you call, and you tell him or tell him or her what the problem is, and it's up to them to rectify it and get you out of it without blowing your cover. Every undercover has that. And like I say, the hello number is a number that doesn't go to a to an office. It goes to the, and your contact agents also have fake, you know, fake ID. You know, they're not operating under their FBI identification. And
so if they got to come like bill you out, they can use a fake ID and put up cash and get you out of there and then deal with it later.
Exactly.
But there's a real, I mean, go into that for just a minute. There's a real reason why you don't even want to, you want to trust other law enforcement, but we know from experience, right, is that some of these folks may be getting a little cash on the side to inform to say, hey, I just had an FBI undercover guy in here. He just got, you know, he just got his bail posted and this is the name he's using.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's why in any operations that we do, and unless we're in partners with the particular agency, we don't inform other agencies. I mean, if it's an undercover operation with DEA, if it's an undercover operation with a specific police department, but if it's not, if it's an outside agency, we don't inform them of the identity of the undercover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's good. I mean, it's good reasoning too. And I don't think a lot of people, I mean, we've talked to a lot of people who've worked undercover. We just had Jack Garcia on here. We talked to some other ones and, you know, there is so much thought. We talk with guys from ATF that worked undercover, DEA. A lot of work has to go into it to backstop that, because all it takes is just one little enterprising person now in this day and age of the internet to do some checks. And I mean, it's easy to blow a cover in this day and age with Al Gore's amazing internet than it was, you know, back 20 years ago.
Oh, definitely. I mean, that's one of the main problems today with undercover is the backstopping. I mean, because of the internet, you know, back in the day, you can backstop somebody 100%. With the internet, you really have to work to build an identity for somebody. But there's always going to be a hole in it because of the internet.
There's always a hole in people's resume too. I like the one guy that they hired. There's a big row going on. I can't think of who it was. Actually, it was Steve, you'll appreciate this too. It's the prosecutor here in Loudoun County, the one that we did the whole episode on with the kids in the school. But she hired a guy who was actually a convicted sex offender. But for 6 years, you know what was on his resume? He was at the Department of Justice.
He was. He wasn't lying.
That's true.
She couldn't get him for lying right on his application, right?
What did you do at the Department of Justice? Yes.
Well, I was inmate 68791.
always interesting. And you're right, too, because, you know, when you talk to guys that worked in the intelligence business or CIA, 20, 25 years ago, carrying multiple passports, fake passports, was an easy thing to do. Not that you wanted too many because you got to keep your legend intact. Now, with biometrics, the way they enroll you, there is no way around it. You come in through a country, I know my eyes, my fingerprints been scanned. It's very difficult, and they're doing what they call true identity now. It's like, hey, there's no more like non-official cover. You're not going to get a legend. You're going to use your real name because, to your point, you've got the social media, you've got the history that it's so easy to check now. Now you've got to do a good job of keeping them under the radar so you don't associate them with, you know, intelligence work.
Yeah, you have to use your true identity to get into a foreign country if you're doing undercover work. And then once you're there, switch, you know. It's a problem. Or, you know, inform customs of the identity of the undercover. But then, you know, everybody talks, and it's not intentionally, but, you know, gals and guys are sitting around having a beer. Hey, you know, that's why in my undercover, Donnie Brasco one, we didn't tell anybody. I mean, not even people in the New York office. The only people that knew were the supervisor, the SAC, and a couple agents.
Yeah, because there's three forms of communication: telephone, telegraph, telecop. You start telling stories and drink, and
everything else was pulled. My records were pulled. They were pulled at headquarters. If I went into another, when I went into another town, I didn't even tell the FBI office I was there. We never even told them I was there.
Well, that's a good jumping off point. Let's start laying the groundwork now, because we've got a really good sense of some of the stuff you worked on. So let's talk about, start giving us the background of how, first of all, let's talk about the name before we even get into this. Was the name created for the operation, or had you used that name previously as your UC name?
I had used the name previously in other undercover operations.
Where'd you come up with the name?
Yeah, what was the origin?
I just liked it. Seemed like, you know, might have read about it somewhere.
And it ends in a vowel, so it's a perfectly Italian.
Yeah. And my middle name is Dominic. So, you know, Donald wasn't that far off, because, you know, they call Dominic Don sometimes, or Dom. So, you know, usually in undercover, you want to take a, you don't want to change your first name, you know, because you want to answer that. But, you know, I didn't have any problem answering to Don. So.
So start laying the groundwork first. When did this whole, how long had you been on, and what was the impetus for starting to say, hey, look, Joe, we want you to do this?
Well, as I said previously, you know, I was on that year and a half car theft ring. We finished that up. I get back to New York, and my supervisor, as I said, was Guy Barato. He was the supervisor of the truck squad, hijacking truck squad. So he dreamed up this idea of an undercover operation to try to infiltrate the fences that were dealing the swag. And since I hadn't been, you know, I had been out of New York for a year and a half now, he says, you want to take this job on. And so I said, yeah. And as you mentioned previously, Morgan, is that a lot of thought has to go into it. You know, you have to, and we did all of this without contacts. What I mean by that is, I went out and got a New York driver's license.
Under Donnie Brasco's name?
Under Donnie Brasco, just like anybody else would. Because I had the, you know, I had the backup as far as a birth certificates and stuff that.
Do you have a criminal record?
I did, but the only criminal record you want is petty theft, stuff like that. You don't want anything too deep.
Where you like do time at a place where they can check people.
My only incarceration was maybe, you know, 10, 15, 30 days in the locals, you know, actually in Arlington, Virginia. I had a record there.
Did you actually do any time in the jail just to backstop that, or they just put that on the record?
They just put that on the record. Yeah. Yeah.
Because you, that would have been a great vacation, 10 days where you don't have to do anything, 3 hots and a cot, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you don't want to put down that you did time, because, you know, you can't talk about doing time in Attica or Lewisburg or somewhere. How are you going to discuss that?
Right.
You know, you can't do it. But, you know, 15 days, 30 days in, you know, in a local jail, what's.
And they got so many people going through those jails. It's not like. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's no way they could check. All they can do is check and say, hey, yeah, you know, if you have a bent cop or bent fed that can check the record, yeah, you know, he did 15 days for robbery or whatever.
But stop right there for a second, because the other thing I've always been fascinated to, everybody's tactics for doing it and how the Bureau did it. What's the process of putting in those criminal records? When you talk about backstopping, you actually have to start putting in records in these things, right? Because you have to have a trusted source to do that too. So What's the process for how you guys went about putting in your criminal records into the court system? You know, because somebody goes down and says, "Hey, give me the file on Donnie Brasco." Somebody has to put that information in there.
Yeah, well, the bureau would at a headquarters would get that done. And you know, there's always somebody that look, and you guys can attest to that. You're always working with a local that works close with you. You know,
you got to be able to trust somebody to get some
of
this stuff done.
Trust, yeah. You know. So he might be the arresting officer, you know, but it doesn't mean that they know about the case. It's just that, hey, you know, we need to get this arrest record in, you know, on a Donnie Brasco. So, and that's how they would do it. Yeah.
So he would just write something up and submit it, even though I mean, he obviously didn't go out and physically arrest you and toss you in jail. He would just write up the report and submit it.
Yeah, because like you say, you know, in the locals, so many people pass through, they don't, you know.
Yeah.
Nobody can remember who the hell's going through there or who went through there. So
when your boss started laying this out, did you have any idea at that point about how long this was going to be? Did he tell you, hey, it's only like a 6-month operation? Did you get any idea about that?
That's how undercover operations are, on 6-month intervals. That's they're funded every 6 months. That's how they're funded. So everything is 6 months, because if you're not accomplishing anything, there's no sense funding it for a year, 2 years from the get go, you know. But then, like I said, what I did was I went out and got my own, you know, driver's license, like Joe Citizen. Went and rented an apartment at Joe Citizen. I did all these things. I'll tell you a funny story. I went to open a checking account because, you know, you have to pay for your apartment. You got to pay your utilities. And all of that is done by the undercover, you know? So I go to open a checking account in one of the banks in New York City. And the guy asked me, where's your prior banking? I said, I don't have any. He said, well, I need to have some. I said, why? He said, you know, so he gives me a rigmarole. So I said, look, I said, I just got out of jail. And he looked at me. I said, so you're going to punish me by not letting me open a bank account. I'm trying to rehabilitate myself. And you're not going to let me open a bank account because I don't have a prior bank account because I've been in jail. And he got all flustered. And he said, no, you know. So he let me open up a checking account.
Now, did he do that out of empathy or sympathy for you? Or did he do it because of your name and everything he thought you might have been connected?
Well, he thought because I threatened him as far as, you know, what are you doing to me? I did my time. I paid my debt to society. And now you want to punish me again, you know? Do I have to take this further?
Because I got a guy.
Yeah, are these scenarios that you've already worked out in your mind, or that somebody's brought to your attention in the bureau as you're learning to work undercover? Or is this just thinking on your feet as you go along?
You know, Steve, back in the day, we didn't have any. I mean, we had guys that worked undercover, but we had no formal. There was no formal training. You know, the guys that worked undercover back in the day were street guys, you know, with kind of the same background I had growing up in these type neighborhoods, you know, and just surviving the way you survived. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you had, but you had a lot of authentic memories and things to pull on to be able to do your role, because like you said, you grew up on it. You bought clothes, you got swag, you know, I mean, you saw the social clubs. So it's like you already had a good sense for how these things were going to work. It's not like you were just throwing you in into a Florida and you have to become some Southern Florida Dixiecrat, you know, running an operation.
Yeah, exactly. I never tried to be anything else than, you know, than an Italian kid from the North, you know, from Jersey, New York area. Because look, no matter what type of level, all these guys got BS detectors, you know what I mean? And the one thing they can do is detect when you're bullshitting them. So I was always straight up about stuff. I mean, to give you an example, I'm not a drinker, right? Like I said before, I can't even finish a whole bottle of beer. And I grew up in bars. I grew up, my father had bars. I grew up bartending. But I just don't drink. And in any of my undercover endeavors, especially with the wise guys, you know, Donnie, you don't want to have another beer? No, I can't. I can't even finish a bottle of beer. I don't drink. I can't drink. And nobody cares, you know? And I found that to be a problem with undercovers, you know, young undercovers, they think they get, you know, they think they have to be out nightlife and it all the time. You don't. You whoever you are, that's who you are.
Yep.
It's funny you should mention that because one of our earlier episodes with Dominic Polifrone, with ATF.
Dominic? Yeah, sure.
And one of the things he did was, I thought was just exactly what you're doing. He was himself, but he says, no. I remember the one incident, Steve, remember we're interviewing him. They were going back and forth with one of the captains in the police department. It's like Kuklinski calls. And they said, well, hurry up, call him back. He says, I ain't going to call him back. He can wait.
Yeah, exactly.
I ain't running to, no, you got to call him back right away. No, that's not the way this thing works. And so it's having that sense of being a true, you know, authentic person, like you were talking about. Hey, look, if you don't drink, you don't drink. I think they respect that more than you drinking and then vomiting all over the dinner table.
No, you're exactly right. And it's I mentioned young undercovers, but a lot of administrators that don't have or didn't have street experience, you know, they think that everything is, and it's not, you know. I'll call them back when I call them back, you know?
That's what I tell young agents, say, you know, if you got any words of advice, don't be afraid to walk away from a deal.
That's exactly right. And that's one of the points on my undercover schools is walk away.
Mm-hmm. Nobody expects a cop to walk away. They expect, you got to make the bus. You got to do this. It's like, screw you. I don't need this crap. And then you walk away to go, he must be for real.
That's exactly right. And then you get it for a better price later on.
See, you're negotiating. You're saving the taxpayers money. Look at this, Chief. Not only can I steal cars, I can negotiate better deals on swag.
Yeah, that was Morgan, we did that episode on my last undercover, and I didn't do anything like you did, Joe. Mine were just very short-term things. But it was for several hundred pounds of weed in North Carolina. You know, we popped the guy on the first deal. I had a North Carolina trooper pull him over before they got to me and up in Mount Airy, which is known as Mayberry from the TV show. And I ran. I like, you son of a bitch, you set me up. And I put I put all the guilt on them and I just hauled butt. 3 months later, they're calling me. Hey, listen, okay, we know it wasn't you. Can we get together to do another deal? Well, okay. Yeah, I guess I got time for you.
I mean, and, you know, I used to walk away from conversations. You know, before I became really accepted, okay, I knew I should be in on this conversation as far as listening, but I get up and walk away, and then later on I say, Donnie, where you going? I say, hey, this has nothing to do with me, man. So, you know.
You're continuing to establish credibility with these guys is that, hey, look, doesn't involve me. I don't want to be a part of it.
Then they'll
end up telling you.
That's what it is. You know.
Before we get too far into the story, let me just book into it real quick. I don't want to go to the end, but I want to give people a sense of what time frame we're talking about. So from the time you accepted this assignment until the time it was finally over, your UC role was over, give us a sense of how long of a period of time was that?
we started the 6-year operation was the beginning of 75 and ended in July 27th of 81.
Damn.
Now, six months turned into 6 years.
Yeah. We're talking deep cover here too.
Yeah.
So how do you prepare your family for something like this?
Well, it's tough. Luckily, I had been doing undercover work before, but you know, normal undercover work is there's several types of undercover work, right? There's light cover, which is, you know, you meet the bad guys, you deal with them during the day or during the night, and you go home. You normally go into your office. That's what most undercover is. Deep undercover is what a lot of people can't do, and a lot of people don't want to do, because once you leave your office, you never go back until the operation's over. You move out of your residence into your own apartment, and you very seldom do you get to your you get back home.
It's kind of like being divorced in a sense, right? And having your parents or having your ex and your kids move to a completely different location. You see them very rarely.
Yeah, basically what it is, you leave your gun and badge and your credentials in the office. The only thing you're out there with is your fake ID. That's the only thing you're out there with. The only contact with your agency is with your contact agent. And maybe your supervisor. That's your contact. My family lived across the country. When I started the operation in New York.
When you say across the country, we're talking West Coast then?
Yeah. The operation started in New York, and they were out west. Yeah.
Hey, players, that is the end of part one. Part two, as always, comes out on Thursday. In the meantime, check us out at Game of Crimes on Twitter, at Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook, at the Instagram. But where you got to be? Got to be on patreon.com/Game of Crimes. We have a ton of good stuff, including, if you are at the right level, Guardian of the Realm and Warden of the Throne, we have just released part one, episode one of The Real DEA Narcos, talking about The Real DEA Narcos, Cali Edition. Chris Feistel and Dave Mitchell go in-depth 16 hours about how they took down the Cali cartel. Information you will not hear anywhere else in the world, not on Netflix, not anywhere, not in a book, only right here on Game of Crimes at patreon.com/Game of Crimes. In the meantime, also go check out our webpage, GameofCrimesPodcast.com. We've got the latest merch, pictures for every episode that we put up, books that our guests write. We only put up books that they write. We put them up there. So we thank you once again for being a player in the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes.